Well, they got, in 73 there was an oil crisis. And I was the top guy in the Pentagon for oil and energy. Why was it? Because Clements, Bill Clements, who was the deputy secretary, he knew everybody in the oil business because he had an oil field drilling. He was not permitted to be the guy because he knew too much about it. He was involved. He still owned Sedgo stock. So the net result is I went to a lot of cabinet meetings that I shouldn't have any more been in than the man in the moon. But it shows you the perverse elements of the Washington scene, and you probably know that better than I do. We didn't know where the hell oil went in the Defense Department. And so I called up a few of my friends in the business. I called up an Exxon. I knew the president of Exxon Chemical. I said, I need a guy that really knows transportation and movement of oil very well. And he sent me a guy that I think was in Texas someplace. The guy came up to Washington, and Jim Schlesinger said, after he'd been there about a month, you got to get rid of this guy. I said, I can't get rid of this guy. He's moved his family up. But that was because the press was homing in on people that were knowledgeable. If they came out of an Exxon or a DuPont, we had to find him another job. I forget where the hell he went. He stayed in Washington, but he was not in the oil and energy business. But I'll tell you one other story about not knowing anything about the... we didn't know where the hell the fuel went in the Defense Department because it was so cheap up until that time. And I said, I was given the job of putting together a system. I said, gee, how am I going to do that? Well, there was a guy named Admiral Sonnenschein who had been head of the shipbuilding. And he got canned from that job because he used to sign a handshake the overruns on a carrier, which took 12 years to build. Well, the Congress didn't like that. And if you've ever tried to figure out who the hell is responsible for changes, it's damn hard to do it. You have to do it by hand. But he got canned. So somebody said, get Admiral Sonnenschein. Well, that guy, I gave him the job, which is to find out where the hell we use fuel in the Defense Department. And he put together, I don't know, 500 or 600 guys, which he got tasked all around. And in about 3 months, we had a system where we could find out where the hell, what, when. And it was interesting because my job was to give a report at the weekly staff meetings that where the Joint Chiefs of Staff were there. And, God, I was showing the Joint Chiefs that the oil consumption was going down. They said, you're going to destroy our readiness. I said, look at the readiness is still where your guys say it was. And it was interesting to me because I've never forgotten this, that people, I got to tell you one other thing, the Congress was very unhappy with the comptrollers of the services because they would overrun their budgets. So they passed a law that said if a comptroller overran his budget, he could go to jail. It takes about 2 years to get money, roughly 2 years to get money from the Congress. There was one other factor I can't recall. But the facts are is that we didn't know where this stuff went. Well, we found it out, and it was interesting. People were ingenious in the military. So a guy, instead of taking a 150-mile run to a bombing target, did it in 50 miles. And the consumption went down. The readiness stayed about the same, and I don't know where the hell the fuel consumption is up, but it went down a lot. A lot more than, again, knowledgeable managers said it should have gone down. And we at least we finally knew where the hell the stuff was going. Didn't know it.
Who did you report to directly?
In the Pentagon? I reported to Clements.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he managed the Pentagon. Schlesinger was as bright a guy as I've known, but he worried about the relationships with the Congress and with the White House. He was damn good at that. So I saw a lot of Schlesinger But mostly when it had to do with testifying before the Congress or before the... One day he called me an agent provocateur. I had to look it up. I said, what the hell does he mean by that? Well, he probably meant that I was probably being obstreperous with the Congress.
Like upsetting Dan Flood.
Exactly, right. Oh, God.
You ran into, of course, the old acronym problem again.
That was a big problem. God, I asked a lot of guys, said there must be a dictionary of acronyms somewhere. I'd say about 6 or 9 months, I finally found a defense contractor that had put one together, and I finally got one. But that thing was about that thick, you know. And, the thing is interesting. Acronyms had become words. Mm-hmm. And so the few times I interrupted a presentation to say, what does that acronym mean? The guy didn't know what it meant. I've got to tell you one story about acronyms. Even in DuPont, when I moved from the Alchem to explosives, AN was ammonium nitrate. No, AN was acrylonitrile. In explosives, acrylonitrile was ACN, and AN was ammonium nitrate. So, if you think a guy didn't get confused, that's why I didn't know what ANFO meant. Ammonium nitrate fuel. I said, what the hell does ANFO mean? Acronyms are tough, but they're everywhere, as you know better than I do. Mm-hmm. They're everywhere.
You have said that you had to change your management style to cope with the magnitude of the assignment.
Well, somebody said, asked me a few times, how did you manage your job in the Pentagon? I said, by doing only the things that I thought I could make a change in or help. And while I have no way of estimating that, I would say I probably worried about 1%, maybe 2% of the job. I had a staff of... my office had a staff of 225 people that would answer the mail. The mail was enormous. And every night I'd get my aide, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Marines. We'd spend, I don't know, an hour just signing mail. And I'll never forget, I said to him, I don't know what the hell I'm signing here. You're explaining it to me. But you had to sign it every day, and I'm lucky as hell that I didn't get nailed for something that I signed. And anybody could have said, you've signed that, right? But the stack was about that high every day of stuff. So, yes, I had to change my style, because there's no way in God's green earth that I could cope with... I became a people person. I've got some interesting documentation that I got from some of the services that I concentrated on the people that made changes in the Defense Department or were in a position to make changes, whether they wanted to make them or not. And by the way, change in the Defense Department was very tough to do. Deputy Secretary of Defense before the administration before I was Dave Packard, of Hewlett Packard, and he recognized early on that these big defense projects were managed usually by a brigadier general or a colonel who had never had any experience in managing a project in their lives. And so he said, and their tour of duty was usually about a year and a half, 18 months. He said, we've got to keep these guys in their job for at least 5 years, and we got to develop a college, which was, I think, was established in Fort Belvoir. Not the industrial college of the Armed Forces. This was separate. To train a guy on how to be a project manager. Well, I was involved. I went to Washington about 10 or 12 years after I left there, and I talked to the guy who was head of the industrial college. I said, are you guys still doing what Dave Packard said? No, they weren't. Which taught you a whole hell of a lot about the ability to make changes and would the changes persist after you've made it. Because the civilians, if they don't like what the hell you've done, they'll just wait you out. Because the average tenure of a presidential appointee is about 18 or 19 months. Mm-hmm. And those guys know that. So it's the rare person like Rubin that stays 4 years. Very rare. So it's tough to make changes that the organization doesn't like because they'll just wait you out. And the changes that they do like, they'll make it, but they're few and far between. Because one of the things that I learned in the Pentagon was a military guy is trained to take orders. Yes, sir. Matter of fact, the lieutenant colonel who was my aide the first half of the time I was there, when we'd be in the room alone, he'd still call me Mr. Secretary. I said, Christ almighty, call me Art. Well, he couldn't call me Art. He wasn't trained. And so we were trying to train project managers to deal with maybe 1,000 subcontractors and a defense contractor, which means you couldn't control those guys. They had a hell of a time understanding how you controlled somebody that didn't report to you, right? Because, again, in the military, God, everybody, and should. The military does work that way. So whether that succeeded or failed, it probably failed. Because you can't get a person to compartmentalize their brain. One part is for the military and one part is for a defense contractor. And they don't have guys stay 5 years. Because that screwed up the promotion process. All on computers. And God, you had to move a guy around a hell of a lot. And the other thing, impression I got was some of the brightest guys I've ever known were in the military. They were well-educated guys. Better than I, since I'd never served in the military, I didn't know too many guys. But it's amazing how many guys had PhDs. Because during the lack of war in the post-war era, a lot of these guys got PhDs from Harvard or MIT or Penn or what have you. Well-educated, bright guys. And also, a few of them came in to me and said, I'm leaving. I said, the hell are you leaving? He was 48 years old. He had 30 years in the Air Force, and the Air Force had a rule that if you three-star general, that if you weren't going to get promoted, out. So these guys at 48 had 30 years service, which started the year they joined whatever West Point in the Air Force. And at 48, they'd retire, and they got a lot of them got damn good jobs because they were very good managers. The Air Force was number one, the Navy was number two, the Army was number three in that regard, from my observation. But it's a different, totally different environment, and it's going to stay that way for quite a while.
There are, I listed here, 5 unique aspects of the Department of Defense that you've observed. The one we've already talked about, the revolving door management problem. We've talked about the vast amounts of money.
Yeah.
Control by Congress. You've given me some examples of that.
Totally controlled by Congress. Matter of fact, one of the guys, I went to a party for a congressman from Louisiana. Can't think of his name. And this was after the Young Turks in the Congress had decided that seniority wasn't important. So this guy was deposed. I think he was probably head of the Armed Services Committee. He was deposed. Well, we went to a party for this guy after he had been deposed. And this guy was getting drunker than a hoot owl. Drunker and drunker. And some guy got up to give a speech. And that guy was Jack Kemp. There were about 35 or 40 people. Everybody, including wives who had probably never given a speech in their life, everybody felt constrained to say something nice about this guy. Which said a hell of a lot about Those changes don't occur very often in the Congress. And by the way, I think one of the reasons that we had such large increases in debt in the United States was the fact that the key committee chairman had a lot of control over their committee. And they could deliver the goods to the executive branch of the administration. Once that was destroyed, there was nobody, basically, that could deliver the vote. And the net result is we spent money we haven't had. We've printed money for 30 years or thereabouts. At least that's my opinion.
Well, we've talked about vast amounts of money, too.
Yeah,
you've given me those stories.
Good. Still big.
And yet I was reading just the other day about the Enterprise and how understaffed it is, and they're short on spare parts. And I read that and said, but, you know, there's still a lot of money there for them to spend. Where did it go?
Yeah, it does. The defense budget is still about $225 billion. That's a lot of money.
Another one of these unique aspects was many constituencies you had to serve.
Yeah.
And then the last one, which intrigued me also, was the lack of loyalty by some staff members.
Well, we tried to save money in the Pentagon, and I'll never forget the time. I think we wanted to spend a small amount of money, and I mean $10,000 or something like that, to find out whether we could get a third-party contractor to do the cleaning in the California base. Fort Ord, I think, was the name. Well, somebody on our staff leaked that to the congressman from that district, and the congressman wrote about a two-line item that said the Defense Department can't spend any money to do so-and-so. That was what I mean by you had to know where the hell, who you were affecting, because the Congress very easily can cut off what they don't like or what they think adversely affects their district. And one of the things that I've never forgotten, because it's important, is shutting down a military base is damn tough. When I was in the Pentagon, we tried to shut down the Philadelphia base. And God, they had so many powerful friends that they kept it off until, I think, about last year or the year before last. It's damn tough. We shut down the Boston Navy Yard because Elliot Richardson, when he knew he was going to be Attorney General, signed the documents and left the rest of us with the problems of dealing with Quonset Point. We shut down a base in Quonset Point, Rhode Island, and the Navy base. And but it was that. And the Congress today has a committee that approves shutting down a military base. Now, the point I was trying to make, the group that reported to me was a group that figured out how to reuse old military bases. And, for instance, the Philadelphia probably hasn't changed. The Philadelphia Navy Yard will be given to the city of Philadelphia, somebody else, for $1. Everything on it for $1. And they'll be given a team of guys that knows a hell of a lot about bringing taxable, just like that shipbuilder, bring him to that site, and eventually you'll have a taxable base. Now, it takes time. But, God, the congressmen moan about the jobs that are lost, and basically it isn't true. There are a lot of success stories, but the press hates to write about those lack of success stories because you don't report good news, you report bad news. And the jobs lost is more important than the eventual improvement. But there are lots of classic examples of military bases that have been shut down, and God, now it brings a lot of revenue in because you got taxable people there, not non-taxable.
Well, in many big cities, they sit on ideal property, very exclusive property. You know,
San Francisco, God, they've got some incredible property in the city of San Francisco, and those of us for years have been trying to get them to get rid of it. God, they don't want to get rid of it. Matter of fact, I'll never forget, because a good DuPont friend of mine retired to the island of Maui, and apparently there was an article in the paper there when we were going to put air conditioning in the volcano Diamond Head on the main island of Hawaii, because it was we were going to build a military base there, of housing, and there's no wind in there. So we were going to put in air conditioning. I got this nasty letter from this retired DuPont guy. I said, what the hell are you doing putting air conditioning in Hawaii? Right? But DuPont, the military, the Army, owned a hell of a lot of property on the main island of Oahu, and they wanted to build a 19-story hotel for the military. We said, you can't do that. They said, the hell we can't. We're going to use the money from the bar and the Coke machines, et cetera, the finances building, and that building got built. It's still sitting right near the Waikiki Hotel. Beautiful. Beautiful piece of property that they should have sold. But it's interesting the amount of money that the military gets from that is not authorized by the Congress. From Coke machines and bar income and several other forms of many millions. Well, I don't know how many guys there are in the military now. Probably 1.2 million. There used to be 2 million. That's still a lot.
What when you went to defense, did you have a time frame as to how long you'd be there?
No. I think I thought I'd stay there the whole Nixon administration, but again, Nixon didn't last very long. Then I worked for Ford, and even though I was a relatively high-level guy at DuPont, I didn't have much of an estate. So I figured, God, I got to go back to work, and I was 56 when I went to the Pentagon. I left when I was 58. So I figured I had better go back and earn something for my kids and my wife. So I left earlier, well, not earlier than most presidential appointees, but you didn't have to make a commitment. No, I don't recall having made a commitment.
So your leaving was your choice?
Yeah, it was my choice.
Did you have any interaction with Nixon or Ford? Did you ever have a chance to go that high up on the ladder?
Well, I told you, I sat in, I don't know, I never kept a lot of cabinet meetings that had to do with the energy crisis and other crises. Schlesinger sent me to many meetings, and Clements couldn't go to these meetings. So I sat in on lots of and the defense representative sits next to the president. The Treasury, I think, is on one side, and the Defense Department's on the other side. So I went to a hell of a lot of cabinet meetings. How many I went to, I really don't know. And I almost stayed in the government because the Energy Office was established in probably late 73, early 74. Now, it's normal in the government that the Pentagon can staff these offices, which I don't know. The Energy Department has got 10 or 20,000 people. At that time, they were looking for 35. And I'll never forget, I got a call from Bill Simon or his deputy, who was then became the head of NYU, John Sawhill.
Oh, yes.
He said, when the hell are you going to get us those guys? Right? But we finally staffed all of the Energy Office. The guy that became head of that after Sawhill left and Simon left was a guy named Frank Zarb, who's now the head of NASDAQ and the merged NASDAQ and the American Stock Exchange. He was with Smith Barney. Well, I was leaving the Pentagon. He wanted to know whether I'd be his deputy as his Secretary of Energy. I said, no, I've already decided to go back to DuPont. But if Potomac fever had caught me, which I try to avoid, I could have stayed. And I'd probably have been the head of energy at some point in time. Because he'd say, you know damn well the guys wouldn't last very long. So, yeah, I could have stayed, but I'm not a politician. that wouldn't have appealed to me in the long run at all. I just, you had to do things that I don't think I'd have enjoyed. Even though that experience was one of the most fascinating experiences of my life. I got to fly the F-14, the F-15,
really?
On a carrier during night landings and day landings, went down in the sub, I saw the it was a hell of an interesting experience, but I wouldn't make it my career.